This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Hey everyone, welcome to My Millennial Money. Today on the podcast, it's a bonus episode. Earlier in the week, we did an episode about setting up a self-managed super fund if a self-managed super fund's for you. But today we are talking about buying a property with your super money. And we're going to have a lot of fun. It's a bit of a deep dive. We've got Nigel Pritchard. G'day, Nigel. How are you?
Hey, Glenn. Good. How are you?
Not too shabs. You hanging in there, John?
I'm here.
Nice.
Welcome.
Now, Nigel, you are on our preferred broker panel. So John and I have vetted you. We send a lot of our listeners to you who might need a mortgage. So thank you so much. And you've heard Nigel on the podcast before from our live events. And I actually recorded an episode with Nigel, John and I did, I think last year. And we did a deep dive into my own personal situation.
But in the old office.
Yeah, but we didn't ever put that up because I thought it was too much personal information. And so I didn't want to attract too much hate.
We just drip feed it now, don't we?
We do. So, Nige, most of the time when people want to buy a property with their super, well, all of the time, a direct property, you're going to need a self-managed super fund. So, sure. We just all assume that we're talking about a self-managed super fund. You've done hundreds of loans throughout your career because a lot of the time people will often use debt to buy a property in their super fund.
Sure.
So just talk to us about your general experiences and what type of property that you see people buying in their self-managed super fund.
Sure. Well, there's two different types of property that people would buy in their super fund. Obviously, one being residential and one being commercial. So, two different strategies for looking at that. Typically, it's your couple or your mums and dads looking to buy a residential property. And typically, that would be a kind of a newish property. The newer, the better, as John would sort of attest to. And the other ones would be a commercial property. So, typically, that is your self-employed person that would buy a commercial property. I don't see too many, or in my experience, don't see too many average people buying a commercial property because it is a completely different sort of strategy to do it that way.
So on the commercial side, it could be an example. There might be an electrician who needs a warehouse. They will buy that property in their self-managed super fund and their electrical business will rent the property off their self-managed super fund.
Correct, yeah. So I've done a bunch like that where you've got your tradies, their electrician or a plumber that's got a small factory bay that they might, you know, store all their equipment and gear in, and, you know, as opposed to renting that facility from a landlord, they'll purchase that, and then their company or business will then essentially rent that property off the SMSF, which is different. You're allowed to do that under commercial, so you're allowed to rent off essentially yourself if it's a commercial property. Technically, it's the business company that's renting off the super fund. However, in residential, you can't do that. So you can't buy a residential property and then essentially live in it yourself and then become your own tenant. But there's different ruling for commercial.
And I guess likewise with the commercial side, if you're thinking, oh, I will set up a self-managed super fund, I'll buy a home in it and then I will, like you said, Nigel, I'll rent it off the super fund. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. You can't put a related party in there, so you can't put family members in there, nor can you have a property in your own name and then transfer that residential property into the self-managed super fund. But in terms of, I guess, property and financial planning strategies, if you did own a commercial unit in your own name, you can transfer that unit into the self-managed super fund.
Sure.
So again, there's a few different options when we talk about the commercial side. But I guess for our listeners today, we'll probably talk more about the residential property within super because that's kind of, you know, what most people will want to do.
Sure.
You know, as opposed to just going and buying a fish and chip shop and then renting out the business?
I think on the commercial side, Nigel, you would have experienced plenty of this where if you're a business owner, self-employed, small, large, medium, whatever, it's a real high incentive to go and, if you've got the funds in your super fund, your self-managed super fund, to go and buy that commercial space, you know you got to run your business out of something anyway. Mm. Yeah, sure, you can claim the rent if you just had a normal premise that you didn't own, but if you've got an asset that you can actually rent from this your self-managed super fund, you the business, then it's a win-win, isn't it, really?
Yeah, for sure. So I've seen a lot of, you know, successful that being a successful strategy where people do that. It's good for the business financials because, you know, you're renting it technically off yourself. You've got an asset there that you can then on sell in the future as part of the business, which a lot of people would do. They would sell their business as a going concern with that factory or shop front included in that. So it is a good strategy that you see for.
But I think it's also on the commercial side, it can be fraught with danger where people get tied up, like, and I'll pick on, you know, tradespeople for now. Particularly in a business that hasn't matured yet. So you might have a bit of a startup business or, you know, it's 5 years old and you're still kind of in growth mode and you might have a bit in super. I think there's the trap of thinking that you're in the property business where, no, you're an electrician. Like, that's your core business. And I just worry sometimes where you're still growing. Just go and rent somewhere. Just grow the business because you don't want to outgrow it and then you own this factory bay that's custom to your smaller business. Or particularly I've seen it with online businesses where they might have a warehouse to package the stock and do all that stuff. You're a growing business. You're not in the property business. You're in the online business. You're not in the property business. You're an electrician. You're not in the property business. You own a hair salon. Mm. So I think it's very important, like, I'm all for buying a commercial property in the self-managed super fund for your business, but you just need to make sure that you're not putting the property cart before the business horse.
Yeah, your business has definitely got to be established, doesn't it? And you've got to have that long-term view. Where's my business going to be in 10 years' time? Like we do with any strategy, right? You've got to look out into the distance and then bring yourself back. But yeah, like that, if you've got the ability to say, well, I'll run my business for another 15 years. I'm not going to outgrow this space. My value of that office space or warehouse, whatever it is potentially going up in value. And by the time my business has ended, I own it outright. You can sell your business or you can sell the warehouse with it, or you can just choose to sell your business and then you've got the cash flow from that warehouse in retirement, which is a few great options up your sleeve. And you can also determine what rent you pay yourself. So you're the landlord and the tenant essentially. Now, it's got to be fair and reasonable rent as assessed, but that's the other positive of it as well. But negatives.
Yeah, it's a control thing. Like if you are a business owner, sure, you'd want to be your own landlord and sure, you might not have the capacity to buy that property with your own funds, but if you got your super fund there, knock yourself out. And I guess for me personally, like longer term, you know, our studio will probably be in some type of property that my super fund owns.
Mm.
But I've just got to be very careful that I don't pull that trigger too fast because of one location. Like, will I be moving to Newcastle?
Mm.
Will I be on the coast? So that's number one. And number two, will we outgrow it?
Yeah,
so sure. We might just park that kind of discussion there. But Nige, I guess there's two ways to buy property ordinarily. Super aside, you write a big check and you buy the bloody property. Or if you don't have the cash, you write a small check, which is maybe a deposit, and then you borrow for the rest of it. So inside or outside of super, that's how you buy property.
Nigel prefers the second one, otherwise he'd be out of business.
Gets paid, yeah. Now, so I guess let's just talk about, you know, you probably don't need a mortgage broker when if you've got a super fund with a heap of cash and you just want to go and buy property, we'll assume that's pretty straightforward. But when people want to borrow money to buy a property and use their super fund, do you see any initial traps. So, for example, they go to a seminar and why are you grinning?
It's just this, a happy guy.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like they go to the seminar and at the seminar, oh, we'll set up your super fund. We'll bloody do the loan. We'll bloody buy the property for you. We'll choose the property. I've got my view on this, but what do you see in terms of that type of strategy that you've seen, the good and the bad?
Sure. Yeah, well, the overall premise of buying property in supers is great. There's lots of tax advantages for doing it. There's, you know, a pool of money sitting there that you've got access to that, you know, most Australians love property and it's an asset that you know and you can feel and touch, and as opposed to shares, that purchasing property is always sort of a good idea. What I've seen lots, hundreds of super fund transactions, and there is good and then there is the bad. What I sort of firmly believe is that you get multiple advisors or advice from experts in their particular field. So if you're thinking of setting up an SMSF, go and talk to a financial advisor, get them to run the numbers, get an accountant to set up the structure for you and give you your accounting and sort of taxation advice. Go and either source the property yourself or go and get a buyer's agent or someone like John that's got experience with property. And then come and see like a mortgage broker that can handle the finance. There's a team of sort of five different people that have got their individual specialties that need to sort of work together. It's when you go and, like you said, there's a seminar or it's a sort of a one-stop shop where you walk into one room and there's all the people sort of sitting there. They're all under the one roof that they're, you know, may have their own sort of agenda. So, you know, it's very attractive because there's a lot of people that might not be able to purchase in their personal name, or they've hit their capacity individually. However, they've got, you know, there's a couple of hundred grand just sort of sitting there that, which is, you know, a little honeypot that's untouched. So yeah, having access to that, then that sort of opens up, you know, different people's views and what they can do with that. So if you're going into, like you said, a seminar where it's all happening and they're setting it up for you, setting up the SMSF, giving you the advice, doing your borrowing capacity, and then all of a sudden they've got a property that just miraculously fits into that mold.
I think that may all turn out rosy and okay, but I think the key part of that is the owner that has little involvement in the process. So one, they may not understand what's going on, and number two, they're not educated in the process, so they don't really have full control over the situation, right? So it's left to second, third parties to do that work on their behalf, which sounds great at the time. I'll get that all done and it's I've got my money, I want to spend it on property, I've got that achieved. But yeah, it's that understanding part of it that's generally missing, isn't it?
Sure.
And the owner or taking ownership of that process. But yeah, I think just in general, like when I was looking at buying property in self-managed super fund 10 years ago, how much we needed to actually put down as a deposit when we're getting a loan was smaller back then because property prices weren't as high, but also lending conditions were different. To us about the lay of the land.
Well,
now.
Just like before you do the lay of the land of lending, just on that, you know, the one-stop shop, I just want to add, like anything in your life, just have a healthy level of skepticism.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, I get emails all the time, oh, I've been to three advisors, which one should I choose? I don't know who to trust. I mean, if I'm referring you to two advisors, at least there's a filter of John and I have looked at them and they're not sharks. So I think it's not this everyone's out to get me, but just a healthy level of skepticism.
Sure.
Because I'll just add on that one-stop shop, I've seen personal cases of clients where they've gone in, they've had a healthy super balance. Next minute, they turn around, set up a self-managed super fund. Okay, well, yep, that accountant's charged them $3,000 to do that. They needed advice from the advisor in the office. That was $2,000. oh, you're buying two properties now, so it could be $1 million lend. I don't know how much mortgage brokers get paid, but there's another $5,000 or whatever it is. And then we're scooping $20,000 per property. And the wash up is I've legitimately seen clients that have had two investment properties in their self-managed super fund in the same estate, in the same suburb up in the Hunter Valley, where they're been empty, they can't get a tenant, and the prices are worth less than what they've paid for it, and they are screwed.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that also speaks to your concentration risk and your diversification as well, more than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Just going into it with eyes wide open and asking good questions.
So how, in terms of lending, actually, John, would you mind if we just step back a little bit?
No.
And because I will get to the lending part, but let's talk about this limited recourse borrowing. So if we do want to borrow to buy a property in super, how is it set up with limited recourse borrowing?
Sure. So if you're looking at buying, we'll start at the beginning with setting up a super fund.
Yep.
Yep. So so basically, you can have up to four people in an SMSF. I've seen that a couple of times, but that's for more, I guess, high net worth families where they're sort of setting it up that way. Typically, it's you know, a partner relationship. So mum and dad or husband and wife set it up together. They pull their super balances together. They set up one entity as an SMSF, John and Jane Smith SMSF. If you're looking at, and then you can use that to purchase shares and do whatever you want in investing. Or like you said, if you've got enough, you can pay cash for a property. If you're looking at borrowing to purchase a property in your SMSF, in addition to the super fund, what you need to do is you need to set up what's called a bear trust. Now, the bear trust is...
So I'm going to draw this for those watching on YouTube just while you're talking. So if we've set up a self-managed super fund, and I've got the iPad for people listening. You can watch this part on YouTube. You've got the self-managed super fund, and we covered the trustee company in the episode we did on Tuesday. Trustee company, and you've got the members of the super fund, and I'll just draw two stick people, and I'm horrendous at drawing stick people. So they're the directors of the trustee company, and they're also the members of the super fund. We'll just assume there's two people. And then we've got the house over here that we want to buy. And what are we up to now?
Sure. So in addition to...
You can probably see it on the little screen there under the camera.
Okay, yeah, sure. So in addition to the SMSF, the trustee company, there is a third entity.
Yep.
Which is called the bear trust.
Yeah.
So the reason it's called a bear trust, not like the grizzly brown bear.
Bear is
it's,
no
it's bear, B-A-R-E, meaning that there's nothing in it. It's just basically a shelf company.
Yep.
So it's set up that way to for the purpose of what's called limited recourse borrowing.
Yep.
Or LRBA, limited recourse borrowing arrangement.
Yep.
So how it is set up is that the super fund or the trustee company is the borrower.
Yep.
So it borrows the money from the bank.
Yep.
And the owner of the property is the bear trust. So the contract of sale will have the bear trust name and the loan will be in the name of the trustee company.
Yep.
Now the bank takes into consideration for serviceability. It'll take in the members' super.
So serviceability, you mean how we're going to repay the mortgage repayments?
Correct. Yep. Correct. So they'll work out the borrowing capacity on the individual's super contributions.
Yep.
So they're currently
9.5,
and also the rental income that comes into that property as well.
Yep.
Now the reason it's called limited recourse borrowing is that the bank is only recourse, or all they can take to recoup their money in the event of default, is the property. So they've only got the access to the property in the SMSF, even if you had $1 million in the super fund, the bank.
So you could have $1 million share portfolio and a $500,000 property, and if you lost your job, you had no super contributions going in, you had liquidity issues in the super fund, the tenants moved out of the property, and the bank are like, well, you haven't paid us for 3 months, we're coming to take the property off the super fund. If the property was worth less than what you paid for it, the bank can't go after the other assets inside the super fund.
Inside the super, correct.
Yeah.
And outside?
Yeah, that's a good point, John. So outside, typically now the lending landscape's a lot different to what it was sort of 5 and 10 years ago. So most lenders will require a personal guarantee from the individuals or the directors of the super fund. So in the event that they sold the property and they couldn't recoup their money, then they would, although they can't get it out of the SMSF, they would then go to the individuals and say, we need this shortfall.
Yeah. So I guess it is complex and you need advice. But we did talk about the LRBA, and what I want to kind of talk to now, because people are probably thinking, how much do I need to set up this self-managed super fund to buy a property? So talk to us about, and John kind of touched on this before, talk to us about the LVR. So loan to value ratio, if I was buying a property in my own name outside of super, I could put in 5% potentially.
Sure.
And then the bank would lend me 95%.
Correct. Yep. So it's a lot different in your individual name outside of super.
Yeah.
Like you said, you can borrow up to 95%. You can get mortgage insurance above 80%. However, in super, there's, you know, you can't get mortgage insurance. You can technically borrow up to 80% LVR, but typically, from my experience, most banks will basically cap that at 70% LVR. There's higher risk given the limited recourse borrowing back to the fund. Most of them are capped at 70%.
Okay, so what you're saying is if I wanted to buy a residential property in my self-managed super fund and that property was $500,000, I've got to rock up with $150,000 deposit.
Correct.
Which means I need $150,000 in my super fund.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Plus stamps.
Plus
all of the setup costs for the property. So, you know, you've got your stamp duty.
Which is the biggie.
Being the biggest one. And in addition to that, the setup costs are much higher for a super fund loan than an individual. So you went and got a stock standard home loan. You might pay nothing for an application fee. You might pay $500 for a basic application fee.
Yeah.
And
you've got to set up a bear trust as well.
Correct. Yeah. So setting up a super fund, we've probably already covered the setup costs for a super fund.
Yep.
However, when you're purchasing in an SMSF, correct, you've got to set up the bear trust, which is another expense to the fund. The application fees are generally a lot higher, depending on what lender you go to. I typically allow about $4,000 for setup costs. They're typically a percentage of the loan amount is the application fee. In addition to that, you've got your legal fees. So you've got your standard conveyancing fees to handle the contracts. And typically most lenders will want you to get independent legal advice on the personal guarantees that are involved as well. So in addition to your normal conveyancer, you've got another sort of a grand there in sort of additional legal fees.
I mean, we mentioned this in the last episode, didn't we? The SMSF is basically a company, right?
Yeah,
so sure. A lot of property heads...
it's basically a trust, John.
Yeah, well, but it's treated as a company. You do your annual tax returns and whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of property heads out there will go and set up a self-managed super fund for the pure aim of just buying a property. So the cost of having that tax return and all the fees of purchasing property and all that is basically attributed to that property alone and the yield associated with that.
Yeah, and I guess I'd probably add to that A lot of lenders will ask for a 10% liquidity in the fund upon settlement of the property. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, correct. So it's one thing to have all that cash, but the banks want to see that you've got some surplus in the fund. So they don't want you to put every dollar in the fund and then the day after settlement you've got $10 in the super fund. There's nothing left in it. Because it's difficult to get money into the SMSF, they're limited to how much you can put in with your contribution caps and whatnot. So most lenders will want to see some surplus cash in the super fund,
yep,
in the form of what they call liquidity. So that, and that can be up to 10% of the property.
Yeah, so realistically, on that $500,000 residential property, we need $150,000 deposit.
Sure.
We need $50,000 left over as a cash buffer in the fund, plus maybe $25,000-$30,000 of setup costs.
Yeah.
You know, we're up to maybe $230,000.
Correct.
In the super fund to even pick up the phone to even inquire about this stuff.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's a lot of money, but if you're a working couple and you've both been working for 10, 15 years, you might both have $150,000 in the super fund each and then you can join your money. That's fine, but I guess for the average punter out there, it's going to be off the table.
Correct, yeah. If when you break it down to a macro level, the cost quite often outweighs the benefit unless you're looking at a very cheap property. You know, you're looking at something for $300,000 or something, which, you know, obviously limits your options out there. But to have access to, you know, a broader sort of range of properties and things like that, that 200 benchmark, that's pretty much where it sort of comes in.
Yeah. And we've done it a little bit with especially regional businesses and investors where they just want to buy local and 300 is quite comfortable for them. So it's all relative as to what your strategy is. But 10 years ago, 300 was the norm, wasn't it? So That's right. You could borrow at 20% money down. So you're in for $60,000 plus costs with some liquidity there. It's still probably only going to be $100,000 that you need. So That's very much changed, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, talk to us about interest rates inside the self-managed super fund.
Sure.
Do the banks charge more? And can we do principal and interest? Can we do interest only? What type of mortgage strategy stuff can we do inside the super fund?
Sure. So the way the banks price it, because it's a company that's borrowing, so it is a commercial loan. So the interest rates are much higher than your current individual interest rates.
And is that because there is no lender's mortgage insurance? It's generally commercial, so it's just seen as a high risk business anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so if you got a commercial loan in your individual name, you'd typically be paying higher than your individual interest rates anyway. But with the added complexity and risk to a bank, the interest rates are higher. You're looking at anywhere up at the moment up to about 6%, compared to looking at, you know, under 3% if you're looking at a residential. So it's basically double the interest rate. The same thing, you can have interest only and principal and interest. However, it's not as attractive to have interest only because you're not getting that, you know, cash flow or negative gearing benefit in the super fund. So typically most people will set up as a principal and interest loan to try to, you know, extinguish that debt so they've got a paid off asset when they get to retirement.
Yeah.
How is their appetite at the moment for interest only? Because I imagine that interest rate itself would be higher again than principal and interest.
Correct, yeah. So interest only again makes it more expensive. So and it just adds to the lender's risk. So it's again, it works out costing you more in the long run. And then also you can borrow up to a 30-year loan term, so similar to in your individual names. However, if you're doing an interest-only term at the start, say, for example, 5 years, then you've got to pay it off over 25 years. So your payments will start off cheap, but then in 5 years they're going to go up.
Mm. So being commercial loan, are they looking at the postcode as well? Because like in Resi, in a lot of cases, they'll look at where the region is, class A, B or C and assess it from there. Are they doing the same thing?
Correct. Yep. So if I've got a new client that's purchasing a property in SMSF, the first thing I do is I'll go out to the banks and say, this is the address of the property. What can you lend up to against this. So what's the maximum LVR that you can lend against this property? So they might in, you know, Sydney CBD, they might lend up to 80%. Whereas if you're looking at regional, or if you're looking at a factory bay in Timbuktu,
it might be like, yeah, give us.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had lenders LVR just recently that will, in a city, Brisbane, in sort of a high rise development, one lender said that they'd lend 50% LVR.
Yeah, wow.
Their risk yeah, in that area and that postcode was that high that they said, we'll do it, but at 50%
on our terms.
Which means, you know, in that 500K, you'd need 250K
just as a deposit,
plus your buffers and your stamps. Yeah.
And it may also be that in that example, they've already got exposure in that postcode?
Correct, yeah. So we're talking commercial lenders that are, you know, they're not a large bank that's got billions of dollars sort of there ready to go. So their exposure is a lot sort of smaller, or their risk is a lot higher than that. So what they'll do is they'll look at the overall postcode, and then they'll look at that individual property that you're purchasing, whether it's a house and land, or if it's a one bedroom apartment or whatever. Typically it's a
cool. Now we're going to take a quick break, and then when we get back, we're going to talk about renovating the house that we've just purchased in the self-managed super fund.
Well, that'll be interesting.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click get help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. We also have a panel of trusted mortgage brokers we can connect you with to get you into your first home, an investment property purchase, or to review your current loan if you don't have a broker. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click get help.
All right, so we've purchased the property. The property is settled. We want to obviously make money from property. It just so happens we're buying it in our self-managed super fund. We want to renovate the kitchen. Can we get the bank out to revalue the loan and draw some equity out of that loan? How does it work in super?
No. So in super, you cannot borrow to improve an asset. So it's a pretty much a blanket rule. So you cannot borrow an additional 50 grand to subdivide it. You cannot borrow 5 grand to upgrade the kitchen. You can refinance an SMSF loan. I've done a handful of those, but it's got to be what we call a dollar for dollar refinance. So if you owe $212,000 on your current loan, you've got to replace that with a $212,000 loan with a different bank. So you can't increase at all. And also you cannot access the equity or the future equity in that property. So if you buy it for 500 grand.
And it's gone up to 700.
It's gone up to 700 and you've gone, beauty, I've got 200 grand. Like you would do in an individual name, there's some dormant equity there. Let's take out a second mortgage against that, use that for deposit and buy another property. You can't do that in super. Basically that equity just kind of sits there until you get to retirement or you sell that property.
Yeah.
So could they use the principal that they've paid? Well, sorry, not the principal. They could have put extra funds into the self-managed super fund or an offset account within there. Are they able to use that for their next investment potentially?
They cannot redraw out of the loan. So if they've paid into it, they can't redraw back out of it. Yep. I've seen a few instances where people have had money just sitting there and thought, oh, I'm paying 6% interest over here, I'll just dump 20 grand in it. And I had one client where it was in a strata building, and they needed a special levy to do the outdoor shutters of the building, and it was 20 grand and they wanted to get the 20 grand back out. And I said, sorry, buddy. That's sort of spent. So then they had to, they had to dip into their own pocket and put a contribution into the super fund. So, but you can certainly use cash. So surplus cash that's in the super, you can use that to either purchase another property or back to your sort of renovating. If you need to do improve the or maintenance to the property, you can use cash to do that. So if you buy something that needs a little bit of work, you can use cash money to.
But it's almost like you're really limited because you can't basically buy the property, throw your brother or sister in there and renovate it while they kind of live there. Like, you can't do it. It's just got to be buy it, get on with your life.
That's right. Yeah. So trying to buy a newer property is typically the go, because you don't want to be renovating it. You don't want to be pouring money into it, because you're using all of your cash and you're
technically speaking, like, if you're, you've got a property and I don't know, that's got solar on it, for example, and there's a problem with the solar and you need to spend $5,000 to fix the solar, you can't just get the $5,000 out of your own personal bank account and fix a solar with, because technically that $5,000 is seen as a contribution to superannuation. It's got to come out of the self-managed super fund bank account. Like, it really is more of a complex property investing strategy, and you just really want to be sure that it's the right thing for you.
That's right, yeah.
The big one is the contract in relation to self-managed super fund. So you can only have a one-part contract, can't you? You can't have a two-part contract, like a house and land example, where there might be a land contract and a house contract.
That's correct, yeah. So a lot of people, you buy a block of land and then you build a house on it. Mm. You cannot do that in super. So you can't have what John was referring to, like a land and construction contract. It's got to be a completed contract. So essentially you're buying like an off-the-plan apartment, for example. You sign a contract and then you pay a deposit and then there's an end figure. Mm. Some builders will do that for land and construction. It is somewhat difficult to find a builder that will build just a stock standard residential house in that at that instance, but you can find them, I guess. Yeah. Mm.
Well, they'd need to be in that case. They'd need to be the owner of the land and the builder, basically, to have that one part contract.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I just wanted to give people a bit of a look under the hood of the complexities of buying a property with your super monies, and it might not be for everybody. In fact, even if you did have between you and your partner $500,000 in your super fund, I think it's the question, well, is it a broader strategy we want to do? Because we know that each super self-managed superannuation fund needs an investment strategy. You know, you are trustees of your own money. Mm-hmm. Is it wise to have that pool of money for its members just in one asset class? And the members happen to be you. But as far as, the ATO and the auditors see it, the members are the members. Just because you're the trustee, it's completely separate. So I think it is more fraught with possible danger, more costs associated, and do you want more drama in your life? I mean, John, you've got a self-managed super fund and you've got property exposure in the fund.
Yeah, and I think if you've listened to all this and you're still pro-property in self-managed super fund, you want to go ahead with it, that's great. Know the positives, know the negatives, like we do with anything. I would just say if you're gunning for a, let's say, a 4% gross yield outside of super, inside super you would want maybe 6% as a minimum, just because those extra costs that we spoke about. Just keep yourself cash heavy inside your super to keep the cash buffers, to keep the running costs under control, so that you're not the last thing you want to be doing is using your personal income, your future income, to prop up a property that's only yielding 3% inside super.
Yeah. Do you have any final comments, Nige?
I guess just to sort of bring it all together, get the right advice. So go and talk to a planner and work out your investment strategy. Where do you want to get to? Is the end goal? It is a long term strategy, unlike a property in your individual name that you can buy it, renovate it and flip it in a year or two or five or ten. Buying a property in super is a retirement strategy. So you're going to keep that until retirement to get any of the benefits out of it. So it you need that extra advice. Seek multiple people in their specialist field so they can give you their individual take on what you're looking at doing.
Because it's like, and I'll just chat on real estate agents for 2 minutes. Hello, how are you? Thanks for listening. It's been real. You ask any real estate agent when you're inside a house they're selling, it is the best investment, isn't it?
Mm.
Like, I don't know, there's a lot of real estate agents who give investment advice, which is fantastic and thanks for listening, but also I don't get my investment advice from a real estate agent. Did I just chat on heaps of real estate agents? I didn't mean to.
Shout out to them. I'm still your friends, guys.
Yeah, I am as well. Yeah. But I think just I've used you as an example. It's like I don't get my car advice from the car salesperson, do I?
Sure.
As to what you want to buy, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Like you walk into Toyota and you talk to the Toyota salesperson.
Yeah.
Guess what the best car to buy is for you? I'm going to say it's a bloody Toyota. So...
Well, which it should be anyway.
Well, John, you're talking to someone here who now owns
a Toyota. He's come across to the
I bought right a Prado, side. Everyone. I bought a Prado to Talbot and I'm pro Toyota because they also make Lexus. Anyway, so yeah. So
that's good. Nigel's, thank you, Nigel.
Yeah, so just your whole thing is just be extra vigilant and just if you're walking into someone's office and they can do everything, just get someone to run their eyes over the actual investment portion of that.
Mm.
And I guess, John, your clarity calls, you know, if someone wants to buy a property, to a point, in terms of strategy, the ownership, it comes into it because obviously if you want to buy a property with your super fund and it does grow rapidly and you build up 400 grand worth of equity in 5 years
–
well, if you want that equity out, you're selling the bastard.
Yeah. I mean, there's as we discussed in the last episode, there's some fantastic CGT benefits of having an asset inside your super, isn't it? But you've got to understand what lets most property investors down is the holding costs in the first 5 years of running it. So you've got to analyze that pretty strictly on the way in. Like we have a buyer's agent service for self-managed super fund, but that's as far as we go. We don't say, yeah, I reckon we should buy this. We just, we don't do enough in it.
And
yeah.
talk to a broker as well. Talk to me, talk to another broker, get them to run the numbers on the current lending environment because that does change dramatically over time, particularly at the moment. The landscape has changed over the last 5 years. Polar opposites. 5 years ago, all the major lenders were doing SMSF. There would have been a dozen different banks that were doing it. Now we're limited to less than a handful that are doing it. So,
something.
Yeah.
Well, but the reason
talk to a broker to run the numbers before you look at doing anything, just to make sure what you're being told is, you know, is actually going to happen. That you're going to get the.
I think a couple of years ago as well, the government they kind of flagged they're going to knock lending within a self-managed super fund on the head, and that was it was a bit of a rush. Everyone was going out buying properties.
Yeah.
And they altered the four members to six as well, didn't they?
They floated it in the Treasury Laws Amendment Bill in 2019, but it's not legislated.
Out.
So it's so you can still only have four members.
Four is the max.
Yeah. Anyway, well, you've been Nigel Pigeon, you've been John Pigeon, you've been real listeners.
It's actually Nigel Pritchard.
Oh, what did I say? Nigel Pigeon. And what did I say to you?
No, I was right.
Oh.
This is Glenn Pritchard. This is Nigel James. I need money.
Yeah, and again, don't listen to two dickheads with a microphone for your financial advice.
Three today.
Yeah, three today. We've got an extra dickhead here. All right. Thanks, guys. Right. See you soon. Bye.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
My Millennial Money supports A21, a charity focused on abolishing slavery and human trafficking all over the world. Check out a21.org.au for more info. If you would like some other giving options, or if you aren't sure about which charity you can support, head to thelifeyoucansave.org.au.
This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, is an authorised representative of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451-289.